movie lovers, welcome back for another Anatomy of Movie here at Popcorn Talk. Today we go into the South as Tony Lip and his boss, the doctor, go on a tour. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going into the South via Green Book, the Peter Farley movie, starring Viggo Mortensen and Mahershala Ali. I have Dimitri Panos.
Hey, movie fans, what's happening?
Hey, hey. And Marissa Serafini.
Hi, everyone.
The gang's all back together.
Yeah.
If you're a longtime fan of the show or just a fan in general, we've been sort of mixing and matching for the past few weeks, but we are complete. For those of you joining us for the very first time, what does that even mean? Well, we get together and we talk about movies in depth. So, yes, we give our opinion. Yes, we review them, but we also go a little bit in depth. So, by that nature, it is going to be spoiler-filled. We assume that you've seen the movie, or certainly don't mind if it is spoiled. And then beyond that, we're going to get into some fun aspects of the how and the why. How did it get made? Why did it get made this way? Culminating into the box office, and so forth. And especially with a movie like this, with Golden Globe nominations out just recently, we can start to speculate awards season. So that'll be fun towards the end. So that's what you can look forward to. If you would like to follow along with all the things we've got going on, we do have a rundown in our description. It's a little PDF. You just click it, and there it is for you. So without further ado, where we usually begin is with our overall impressions. So Marissa, what did you think of The Green Book?
I was really excited for this film because we had Chris Bowers in studio back in the summer of this year. So that was the first time I actually heard about this film, and knowing the premise back then, I was like, oh, this sounds fantastic, and here it is. And I watched it, I laughed, there was moments where I was frustrated, just the prejudice and the racism that are like still relevant, and those themes are still relevant today. And I really enjoyed how it touched upon that, and how it like really brought a lot of awareness and eyes upon and shed that light on, those types of themes. And I liked how they addressed it. And I really liked Viggo and Mahershala Ali, being together. And it was like, it's an unlikely pairing that worked so well. So
pairing in real life.
Right. Yeah. I really enjoyed this film because I went in thinking it was just going to be like straight drama, Oscar drama type of film. But no, I got a lot of laughs out of it. So I really enjoyed it.
All right, Dimitri.
Yeah, I think it's one of the top movies of the year for sure, and it is. It's a true life odd couple story. A virtuoso concert pianist and a Bronx bouncer together. It's a road trip movie, okay? It's a true road trip movie. But it's what becomes of this road trip movie. It's along the way. They forged this very heartfelt friendship that's based on so many things, so many great, cool things, and not so cool things. But basically, it's built on compassion. It's built on music. It's built on letter writing, right? And it's built on a lot of introspection. And it's built on food. There's a lot of food to be had and eaten in this movie. I was hungry. I wanted pizza when I was done.
Unless you're going to eat the whole thing, I don't think it counts.
That was hysterical. And at its core, it's a very simple film, mm-hmm. right? But it comes with very deep bonds. And it really has a really good feel-good ending as well. So, yeah, just a really solid movie making from Peter Farrelly, who we know about from Kingpin, Something About Mary. Usually does raunchy comedies. But when you think about it, his movies at its core have characters that are endearing.
And heart.
And that's why they're funny in those movies. And that's why these true-to-life characters have their appeal as well, through and through.
Yeah, and it's interesting, like a road trip movie, right? It, in essence, certainly Dumb and Dumber qualifies as that, and mm-hmm. Way more funny than this movie. But interesting. He's able to stick within his genre and escalate it, right? And there are way more funnier moments than I expected, obviously. And there are dark moments that you don't expect, and it is a very interesting look at both the time that was 1962 and the time that is. 2018 going into 2019. So I think a lot of what's interesting, I think unlike most movies, is that the two main characters, they don't have a friendship to begin with.
No.
In fact, you know,
they
Tony...
They don't even have an enemy ship to begin with. Yeah. They don't know really each
well,
other.
Well, I mean, in a sense, there is an enemy ship by the sheer nature that... What the movie does very well establishes Tony, the fact that he won't even wash glasses used by black people. He just straight throws them into the garbage because washing isn't enough from his perspective. And so for him to go along with this, and you really, it's, you know, I guess we can kick things off kind of here since it is more or less the inciting incident. He's really just doing it for the money, and this is like this is how high a standard he holds money to that he's willing to succumb his own like moral compass to take on this job.
Well, it is set up that they need the money. It wasn't that he wanted more money, but I also think that as far as Tony is concerned, I did look at him as a man who has a good heart. It's just a little misplaced. You know, even when he took the interview going in, I don't think necessarily he was going in there and he had just like hatred right off the top. He was just saying, I'm not going to press your shirts. I'm not going to do this. I'll drive you, sure. I don't care. That's fine. So there's a misplacement that's one of the great character arcs of the story. I don't think, like, he's... To me, he wasn't, like a flaming racist, like, I hate you. He would have never showed up for the interview.
He was
and
tolerant.
Once he found out,
he was tolerant, yeah, to some degree.
To some degree. And so I think it was a little bit... Like, he needed the money, obviously, taking the job. And I think he also liked that the guy... ask permission of his wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that just goes to show how cultured, let's say, certainly Don Dr. Shirley actually was. Mm-hmm. You know, that he would go so far, and because it is a long time, it is a big ask to a lesser extent and whatnot. Let's take a quick step back, though, Marissa. You want to give us a quick recap on context and history, and then we'll dive into story.
Yeah, so back in the 60s, the Jim Crow laws actually restricted where black people could eat, sleep, sit, shop, you know, what have you, have their social lives, and like what fountains they can use, what bathrooms they can use, and like times were different back in the 60s. So the Negro Motorist Green Book is an actual travel guide that was published annually from 1936 to 1966, which listed businesses, restaurants, hotels for the black community that's safe for them to travel to. So their guidebook. And so that's, you know, really where the title comes from for the movie. And they do use it in the movie, like the safe places, because Vallelonga would actually be at one hotel and Doc Shirley would be at another, and you're like, oh wow, because that's how it was set up. But yeah, so just a little bit of difference in the back then from now, and just like how people travel, especially. And Doc Shirley, when he was younger, he was actually he's basically a legit genius. He studied at the Leningrad Conservatory at the age of 9 and made his concert debut at the Boston Pop Symphony at 18. And then he got his doctorate degrees, and he speaks multiple languages. So he's like legitimately a genius. So and because of his high intelligence, it's a nice contrast to the character of Nick Vallelonga.
Well, which is interesting because Tony, in essence, you know, Dimitri kind of made a point. Like, he's just not initiated. He's not educated. And he makes a point. Like, I know where I'm from. I'm from the Bronx, blah, blah, blah. And that's all well and good. And as he exposes himself out into the world, he starts to gain a deeper understanding of how things really are and his own shortcomings, if you will. And then his life changes. I mean, like, his history from then on after meeting Don Shirley is incredible.
Incredible. Mm. And again, it's what I think makes this story charming, because this isn't just a story about race, right? This really is a story about bonding and friendship and how these two opposites can learn from one another, right? And both of them are, both of them can be very off-putting, right? In all fairness, both of them in their demeanors can be very off-putting. But in fact, that's part of their charm. And I think that's what attracted these, the two characters together, these two real life people. So in what better way when you're stuck in a car? You're stuck in a car for hours to learn about one another. So those are the endearing parts. But in Tony himself, again, when you look at the movie, he wasn't one of those extremist, hateful racists. I wouldn't even go as far as saying he was Archie Bunker kind of racist. I mean, he was playing dice with the African-Americans outside. He chose to stay with them outside as well. His heart, like, he has a heart. It's just a little misplaced. And this movie is about realigning it. Same thing goes with Doc Shirley, you know. And I like it too. It's like, oh yeah, this doctor. And when he's in, you're a doctor? Like, doctor of what? And when he finds out it's a musical, like, he's a pianist. Oh, I'm a doctor of the arts of music. I like that whole, you know, the use of the word doctor, what it can mean. Like, yeah, you don't have to be in a surgery or a hospital.
Yeah. But well, if you have a doctor's degree, yeah, you're literally a legal doctor.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you later on learn that he was also not only linguistics but psychology as well. So it's not just that he's a musical prodigy. He has ventured and dabbled in other aspects. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from what I understand, he was relatively successful and smart within those fields as well. So he's not a one-trick pony either. And I appreciate that. Yeah, there's such an authenticity with all of them. Because even Linda Carolini says, like, wait, you can be a doctor for that?
Yeah.
You know, so she makes that same comment and whatnot. So, like, their languages is so reformed and refined for their performances. And, you know, when they cast Viggo Mortensen, they knew what he would bring to the role. And then they needed, obviously, somebody equally as strong to be able to juxtapose that. I think, as they said, this is perfect casting.
It was.
Yeah.
It really was.
From top to bottom. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the family dynamic. Because I appreciate how we enter into this world. And even you get from the home life. Like, everyone's living in the same bedroom. You know, the husband comes home. He's tired and so forth. And you get it, and no one says anything to him. Like, he's not a bad dad, and even the risk that he takes with, as far as eating contests to win money, you know, so far so good. As long as he doesn't lose the money,
right? 26 hot dogs. That's crazy. And the guy who was eating the hot dogs with him was the actual guy who ate all the hot dogs with Tony Lip back then.
But did he win?
He did. 26 versus 20.
That's what he said.
It's 26 versus 24.
That's what he said. But then moments later, we see him at a pawn shop getting $50. Like, did he win? Like, or did he lose and he pawns his watch to get the $50 to say, I didn't win? And he sees that pawnbroker. He goes, yeah, I'll be able to pay it back and I'll pay you the $60. That's the way I took that, is that he didn't really win. He pawns his watch. Hey, I didn't. Here's $50.
Yeah, I could see it that way, because he is known for telling white lies. Like, the whole movie opens up with him
bullshitting
for the hat, and then getting some money out of it and getting in good graces. Like, I took care of it. Don't worry about it.
Smart.
So, you know, he's a well-intended guy, but he's certainly okay to cut corners as necessary.
Unconventional methods, we can say.
Which I think is rather brilliant. Like, if most road trip movies that I know probably would have started the road trip 10 minutes faster. That's just a, you know, rough guess. But
sure.
But we spend a much longer a time establishing everything. So that way when you get on the road trip, it's happening.
Yes.
And you understand the context much more thoroughly.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this. Your initial reactions as far as kind of them going on this road trip and so forth. And I don't know, like, Tony's adherence, like, he was very adamant, like, I'll get him to his gig, right? He kept saying to the music people, no matter what, yeah, like, he doesn't show up, I don't get paid. I get it. I'm going to get him there. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Did you? What was that initial reaction for you guys as you watched it? Him saying that, just another bullshit lie because he knew that's what he had to say versus actual authenticity.
I think it was interesting because we see this character progression and character growth that we see with Tone and Lip, because at the beginning, once they first started and literally before they even met anywhere, he made other people load the suitcase. So you can tell that Tony was in the position just to do the bare minimum of like what was agreed upon their negotiations for the job. So it's like his job was to drive, not do any other courtesy thing for him. So like that was his bare minimum mentality. But once you see when we get from places to locations and all these different situations that help aided to their situation, and now how Tony would be stepping up in other different directions, like you don't go anywhere without me without my presence, I have to watch you. So like his duties naturally grew from place to place to place, and then it got to a point where Tony had to do something and where Tony wanted to do something for Doc Shirley, and I like that because you can tell just the differences of why he's doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, well, I took it that in part he was being hired to be part bodyguard. I mean, I think it was very much implied where they were going to tour. And it was very much stated, many people came to me, Tony, and told me about your certain talents and basically saying, I know what you put up with and what you're not going to put up with, and this is what I need. He just wasn't going to be putting in, like, he wasn't going to be packing for the guy, especially an African-American, maybe at the beginning of the movie. But we see early on that Tony does have some sensibility of honor when a cigarette girl is being harassed and he punches a guy out. And he doesn't care that the guy is the son of a mobster or something. He just doesn't care. You're getting out of here. Like, you disrespected not only the club, but you disrespected this woman. He has that code within him. And I think that's part of the reason, too, is that why he was chosen for the job, knowing that they were going to be going into some not so savory territory for our Doc Shirley here. So I think that the warming up came, yes, I'm going to take your bag. Yes, you can't go anywhere. You know, once he started seeing how dangerous it really is and seeing the other side of the country, whereas, and I love the dichotomy of what a beautiful country this is. And then he got to see how ugly the country can be. And that's when he was like,
how ugly the people can be.
Right. And like, and but even his you're not leaving without me. Don't leave without me.
Yeah.
But even as he was making that shift, Tony's still Tony because they're having that heartfelt moment. He just turns like, you know, something I've been thinking about since the beginning of this trip. Pittsburgh really isn't the tits. It's just like, okay, you know, that's what you have to say. But I guess in thinking, let me ask you guys this, because I feel like I can pinpoint more of the lessons and takeaways that Tony learned. He certainly learned to write better before he was writing, like, I'm eating chips to his wife. And then, you know, his attempt at you're like a house, it became a sweet, it became a Tony type of metaphor, and there was some sweetness to it. He certainly learned a different perspective and all that understanding and so forth, whereas, and certainly his diction got better. Sure. I'm wondering, what tangible aspects can you point to? Because there are some, but it's a little bit harder, at least for me, to pinpoint what Dr. Shirley walks away with. Besides just friendship, perhaps, which obviously a big one, but...
Go ahead.
I think it was like one that I could... It's not so tangible, but more so you can see the effectiveness of how important it is to surround yourself with people who actually enjoy your presence. Because we always see Tony Lip with his family. His family is like a very, very strong support system. The reason why he's took his job is to support his family. And Tony has friends in like a lot of different places, business connections and what have you. And we really only see Doc Shirley with him and his trio. And even the two other people that make up his trio aren't really with Doc Shirley. They're always in their other car or at another table. They're there for the band when they play together, but they're not actually really there to accompany Doc Shirley as friends. They're there professionally. So, and you can see Doc Shirley, he's lonely in that sense. And there are so many moments where he's always looking out at other people, like at the hotel, and he's drinking by himself, but he sees other people socializing, and you can tell, not to say he's jealous, but he's definitely lonely. He wants that. And when he finally gets the moment where he's accepted into the Tony Lip family at the end, you're like, oh, it's like he now has a group of people, like a support system, which he didn't have at the beginning. So that's a big takeaway for him, I think.
Yeah, I think there are a lot actually more tangible things too. He's a very standoff-ish person, whether that was through life, whether his relationship with his brother, the marriage, the failed marriage. He's a very standoffish guy, and he too shunned his own culture. He wasn't familiar with the likes of Aretha Franklin, or who else are they listening on the radio right now?
Little Richie.
Like Little Richard. Mm-hmm. He didn't want to. He believed them to be performers. You know, he felt himself better than the rest, better than most, better than them all. He had that monologue where he said, I'm not going to be a performer where I have the bourbon glass and the piano or whatever. And I think that scene at the end when they're at that African American blues bar barbecue, and he goes up to the piano, he does see takes the bourbon glass off, but when he cuts loose, it was amazing music, just as beautiful, just as amazing as his concert virtuoso performance with his trio. But at the end of it, he goes, you know, Tony, I would do that once a month for free. I had such a great time. He realizes that there's more to music than just Chopin. And to me, that was amazing. And then through food, I mean, he probably stayed away from fried chicken because he felt it was a stereotype. Right? And when he's offered Kentucky Fried Chicken, in Kentucky, I might add. That was so funny. Kentucky Fried Chicken in Kentucky. He's like, wow, this is actually really good. So I think his world, as educated as he was, I think his world broadened because of Tony. You know, so he had this sense. Use of his language. He also had that sense of loyalty. I thought it was a wonder. My favorite scene in the movie is when he felt Tony was going to accept another job.
Yeah.
And Tony's like, no, man, I'm contracted with you. I'm not going anywhere. And he's like, oh. Like most people he would think would turn away from him. So throughout the movie, the arcs, I thought, on both characters were just wonderful, and you see them happening. So at the end, when he comes to Tony's family, it was like all quiet, and then the guys, what the hell are you standing around for? Get this guy a plate. Yeah. It was a great scene, beautiful scene.
Real good. Side tangent, then we'll get back to it. Like Viggo Mortensen did sit in with the real family, and he just kept eating because he didn't want to be rude. They were like, oh, you know, you don't like the food. And so he kept finishing his plate, only to find out there was more to still eat.
Like a Greek family.
Yeah. That's a very Italian family. Oh. I'll tell you, because I come from an Italian family. It's like, they will feed you till you die, until you, like, they roll you out. Every time I go home, my mom's like, you're leaving with 5 more pounds on you. I'm like, all right, say so. it's very Italian.
He always has
tradition.
An appetite.
It's like, it's food. Everyone loves eating. Yeah.
It's one of the most common things we can get behind.
That's typical meal in Italian, in Italy, and I'll tell you because I've been there, it's like it's a 7-course meal. Like, mm-hmm. That's a regular day.
Yeah, and it's a less preservatives, but you know. Yeah.
You, when you're eating, I mean, it's a great way to converse as well. You know, you're like sharing chicken. So something, it's a great social gathering.
Well, it also flips that notion on its head. Because the, you know, you can, I guess, call it the climax of the movie in Birmingham at the last performance. You know, you take a simple act as eating, and the fact that this is what the movie is going to a head on is that, hey, he's hungry, he wants dinner, and he can't sit at the place he's about to be performed. Now, he's already got the best parking spot in the hotel.
Right.
Green room, not so much, but he is the guest of honor, except for that. And it is, as we're talking, like, it's just food at the end of the day. And I think that's a great way to really illustrate a point of disconnect, like that was a thing.
But think about that scene as well and what that scene led to. So they leave to go get food. They come across this barbecue joint. And what is their feature? What is their best thing? Fried chicken. And it was a great look that Viggo Mortensen gave him. He goes, it was such a fun scene for him because he's literally taken out of this upscale world and he's now put in to another African-American world that also likes different kind of food that he's familiar with. Music that he shuns. The scene there, that was the big eye-opener. And then it's also Tony's biggest bullshit moment that comes full circle, where earlier on he goes to grab a gun, never has to use anything. He goes, "Do you really have a gun on you?" He goes, "No, Doc, I'm bullshitting." And then at the end he goes, he pulls out a gun. It was, again, movie has these wonderful, great moments.
Great setups.
Yeah. Well, I think that moment, right, if anything that they walk away with, there was that great scene where Shirley did say, like, I'm neither black nor white, essentially. And from that perspective, like, as time went on, Tony was beginning to be pigeonholed into that sort of circumstance where he was neither white nor black either. And that was an interesting way to go about it, because you would think that he wouldn't have to deal with that. But the fact that he's the one who landed in jail over a comment of, like, basically Italians are somewhat closer to blacks than whites or whatever, and then he punches the guys out. And, what's nice about the final scene is he realizes that he's doing it beyond just him, because he kept it was all self-preservation in a sense up until that point, masked underneath, like, well, I'm doing it for you, Speaking of which, I want to ask you guys about the pool scene where they hint at Shirley being gay. And it's never been brought up. It's never talked about. And it's just, when you talk about... Because it's one thing to deal with racism, but then you add something like that, and, it takes it to a next level of potential bigotry on behalf of Tony. But the fact that he never brings it up, I think, is very telling. Because I don't... he's starting to accept Dr. Shirley no matter what. And in fact, all kind of walks of life. I don't know. That's the way I took it. What about you guys?
I mean, I really actually enjoy that scene because it just shows just how much Doc Shirley goes through every single day. And you understand why he only performs certain things out in public and why he's so more introverted and more private in his own personal life. Because there's a lot of things that he does in his life where back in the 60s, it's not really allowed. It's not tolerated. It's definitely taboo.
It's not accepted.
It's not accepted whatsoever.
I mean, hell, even today, like, we're still...
Yeah, I mean, like, we've made some progress, but there's still problems with homosexuality and all that. So, but I think the level of when we see these guys at this point in the movie, is just now is just sheer respect out of each other and protecting each other. So it's like, it would feel like too much if we now also brought in a whole nother issue, because I think the main issue that they wanted to really touch upon in this film is about the racism, not about the homosexuality. Yeah. I like they addressed it, but it's not like they swept it under their rug. They addressed it enough where we can still understand what Doc Shirley's going through.
Well, I think, the means to the end for that scene was to actually showcase Tony, because Tony again comes through and says, "Look, Doc, people do strange things." It goes back to what we were saying early on about Tony. He's tolerant to an extent. He knows he's his boss. Okay, he's traveled with him at this point, but he's like, "Listen, no need to explain. Strange things people go do, whatever. Let's just fix this problem. Let's get out of this problem, you know? And it was the way in which then Doc Shirley looked upon how Tony got him out of that problem, right? I mean, it's a pretty, again, simple scene, very deep rooted, because then Doc Shirley gets pissed at him. Did you pay them off? You're basically legitimizing what they did. He goes, no, I'm not, Doc. He goes, I'm getting you out of jail in the best way possible. Well, you're not getting killed, and you're not spending a night, and your reputation is saved, and we can get off to the other show. That's what I'm hired. That's what you had me do. That's how I can bullshit people. I don't care either way. This is what we're doing. I thought it was a really interesting, fascinating scene. And once that scene is done, we don't need to address it again. We already know. There's hardships on this trip. And through those hardships, both the characters learn something.
Yeah, and what's kind of cool, like, they always, you know, you're always trying to find the middle ground and what is the right approach, right? And they, you know, that's an example of Tony dealing and handling something and fixing it, but to, you know, the means, obviously, debatable. But then later on, in the sundown town, the doctor has his own way of dealing with it, and good old Bob Kennedy.
Yeah.
Getting a call and then going down the telephone line from there,
yeah,
until we release the good doctor.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because, and the humility he even has afterwards, because Tony's like, oh yeah, we got Kennedy on our side, and he's like, this is what I had to call in the favor for, really? Yeah. So it's interesting how that dichotomy works both
yeah.
ways,
yeah.
and see it explored. Did you think, like, eventually, once it hit perhaps Tony, did you think, like, he learned from that lesson and to, because the doctor's biggest lesson was nonviolence is the answer, versus Tony, he was always a relatively violent guy.
He's a bouncer.
Yeah.
And he knows right from wrong. He knows when people are being wrong, but that's just his way of handling the situation. Now, too, at the end, you know, when they're going to another restaurant, you almost felt as if Doc Shirley was going to use violence against that guy too. Like, and they both chose the better way. And it's like, come on, Doc, we're getting out of here. Now, I was wondering, where the fuck was the rest of the band? Where's the trio? How come they're not getting up in solidarity?
And, I think they did.
Were they at the club? I didn't see them at the club.
Oh, not at the club. not at the...
Pardon me.
They were at the last performance place and they got out, which was strange. I mean, if I had any sort of nitpick with the movie, it's the fact that the duo from the trio, they seem to know and have... It seemed like a lot of great empathy and care towards the Dr. Shirley, but they weren't, you know, as...
But yet they didn't... Yet they didn't do anything.
That's... Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
because it was more so... I think they just wanted... Because, yeah, they are Caucasian, so they were more comfortable in their Caucasian privileges, and they wanted to, you know, be seen as that social class because, you know, they are paid performers and they're not getting into any trouble. So they witness everything that Doc Shirley does. They feel for him, but yet they don't do anything about it.
Nothing.
Yeah, it's
and so, like, how great of a guys were they anyways?
And even then, like, the one Russian guy, it's not like he was well beloved either.
Oleg.
Like,
no.
You know?
Oleg.
Yeah.
So it's... I respect the movie for highlighting everyone had a way of being looked at and being put down, because it just shows, like, all of it is ultimately stupid.
Right.
You know, there's everyone can point to somebody else and pinpoint something, but why do that as opposed to see what they're actually good at? And
right.
Just because they're on the may appear different, they're actually not.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I appreciate the movie. All right. I guess any other story observations or things you want to talk about before we talk about production?
Well, I want to talk about the letter writing.
Okay, yeah, absolutely.
Because I think, again, it's another charming piece of this movie. As I believe, yeah, Marissa, or was it? No, Marissa, yeah. You're talking about, like, you know, first he's writing about chips. I ate chips today and I dried my socks, right?
Kiss the boys.
Yeah, P.S. Kiss the boys. P.S. Kiss the boys. And I liked it when Doc Shirley's like, what are you doing? Give that to me. Or take this down. And he did, without question. And he said, Doc, at the end, you mind if we put a P.S.? He goes, P.S.? Yeah, could you just put kiss the boys for me? Tony, we'll put kiss the boys there for him. So, and I liked how with each letter, number one, it became folklore back in the Bronx. It's like, oh my God, I want a letter. Those seats, they were great.
She goes, after you make me.
Yeah, after you make meal. Me a dinner.
Like, oh, I could have slapped him.
Oh, that was great.
It's terrible.
Yeah, how about you make me a dinner and I'll write you a letter. But then at the end, where Tony goes and writes, he says, no, Doc, I got this. He goes, let me read it. And the smile. He goes, yeah, Tony, you do have this. It's like he got it. But then when they go to the house at the end, again, another pristine line is when his wife, while hugging Doc Shirley, says, thank you for the help in writing the letters. And he just burst out laughing. I mean, he's in the family.
Yeah. And that's how the movie ends.
Yes.
Like, it ends on a happy note.
Yeah, and at that, he's in. Like, she is so proud and accepting and knows the influence that he had on her husband. That's a great Christmas gift.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was such a wonderful scene. 100%. And the fact that they called him Shakespeare. There's Shakespeare.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the writing letters. And also the moments where Doc Shirley would make Tony Lip, like, do more honest things, like, yeah. The rock, like, yeah. Returning the polished rock, jade rock, whatever that was, and, like, just that 5-minute argument of, like, moral, you know, going back to the moral compass, is like, it's not right to steal, put it back, and then that's still, like, playing out throughout the rest of the film, and that actually became something of Doc Shirley.
It was their,
like,
touchstone.
It was literally their touchstone. But then also the fun moment when they're first eating the chicken, like, well, yeah. What do you do with it? And you throw it out the window. And then he throws out the actual soda, the soda paper cup. Like, nope, he skirted the line with the littering. Pick it up. So I like how Doc had the honest... you know, that moral compass is like, no, this is the line. And I really like that.
The throwing the bones at the car was hysterical. He's like, what do you do? He goes, like this. And so he's like, he's just looking at it going, like, this is, and he does it. And his expression was like, a great weight was lifted off. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, huh. And he was happy throwing more out after. So he was enjoying his chicken. He was enjoying this time. But you're not going to throw full-edged trash.
Yeah. That's littering.
Yeah, it really is amazing. We could do a whole dissertation just on food and kind of the metaphor it implies here. Because if you know, from the start of the trip to the end of the trip, the fact that Tony is sharing his food with him... Versus in the beginning, the wife makes both of them sandwiches, and he makes it. He looks down. He's like, well, he doesn't know nothing. I'm just going to eat the sandwich.
And he just pissed me off or something. Yeah.
So
I'm eating your sandwich, buddy.
It's just such a... When we talk about the simplicity and yet the level of depth that films can have, and certainly this film, is such a simple way to illustrate it.
It is.
And every day, an activity we do 3 times a day.
Yeah, and again, it just goes, there is a wonderful simplicity to this movie. It's not sharp, quick edits. It's not overly fast-paced. It's very simple, but every scene has something impactful and deeply rooted. And that's what I really enjoyed about this movie. And if I just to add to this, one thing that I was thinking about while watching this movie, because it is shot quite simply, right? It looks beautiful. And at the times when he says, wow, what a beautiful country we're in, and you get that, it made me think, like, of God, I am so glad that this isn't a Netflix movie. Like, I am glad I am sitting here in a movie theater watching this with a crowd of people who are equally as enjoying this movie, if not even more so than I. laughing and watching this simple, almost independent film. I know it's released by Universal, but it has an independent feel to it, right?
Very much so. Even the means of how it got made, we'll talk about that
in
a moment.
Yeah, I just felt, God, this works. This is a good movie-going experience that doesn't have superheroes, that doesn't have action, but it has bond, it has friendship. It's another variety, another layer that adds to why the movie-going experience is so wonderful, because you can get so many different things depending on your mood and what you like, and there should be no reason why a movie like this would just feel good. We talked about Instant Family not too long ago, feel good. That falls into the category, and I was so happy to be sitting in a theater with these strangers just enjoying this movie for 2 hours.
Well, number one is this movie was shot in a 2-to-1 ratio, essentially, which is a little bit wider than normal, at least of most movies. But speaking about Peter Farrelly, what's intriguing, like he came to this with the notion, he always wanted, it's that lame question that everyone asks, like, what do you want to do in your career that you haven't done yet? And he's like, drama, of course. And he said, just things finally lined up with this one. It's not like he's been avoiding dramas, but this one was just the one that stuck out for him. He wanted to be a part of it, and in essence became, you know, got involved very early on in terms of the writing and then the directing. And what I appreciate, it's a very indie movie in the sense that you have Viggo Mortensen saying, hey, let's keep shooting, let's go up north into the snow and get some driving shots. You know, you don't normally get that on a Avengers movie, certainly.
No.
You know, not to knock, they obviously do a fantastic job with those, but there's that spirit of, like, let's, whatever it takes.
I'm so glad you said that. You're right. There's a spirit, there's the collaborative effort. There's the, we feel that we're part of something special. We're doing something great. Something is clicking. And we talk about it because people in production talk about it. They can tell when they're part of something good. And that's just a fantastic thing where Viggo Mortensen says, let's get some mountain shots. Let's get some shots of snow, you know? And they just want the best for this movie. And I think it's paying, I think the dividends are paying off.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's very interesting. Like, Peter has been cited where he's both very collaborative, but also has a vision, which I think is a very hard line to, well, it's a very hard balancing act, because in essence, you know, you sort of look at it, well, if you're too collaborative, then you don't seem like you have a vision, or you're not thorough. And sometimes you have too much of a vision that you look at everyone as like sheep and you're just moving the pieces where they may. But they said, no, he blends perfectly, and obviously the result is on screen.
Right, and at the beginning of filming, he actually, like, told the cast and crew members, like, if you have any ideas, pitch them to me. So he was very collaborative in that sense, and the fact that he was open to allow other people's ideas come to fruition.
Yeah.
And not a lot of directors do that. Some do, but to have, like, everybody's input.
Yeah, no, yeah. You're absolutely on the money. You know, and we've heard many other stories, too, where the director will choose a team in which his communication, where they understand the language, in which, you know, they understand what the director, sometimes to a point where they know what the director wants before he's even said it. So that goes into that collaborative process and wanting the project to work and not stifling anybody down, not saying, you know, buddy boy, I know you're a director, but I'm the one who calls the shots here. You know, I'll be the one telling you what to do. There did not appear to be any of that here from crew, but even the actors seem to really want to give their best. And you can tell. You can just tell on this movie.
I mean, Linda Cardellini and Viggo have been cited. Like, they look like they've been married since high school.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, it's a tough thing to portray. But they pulled it off.
They did.
Very well.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's, I've crushed on Linda Cardellini since like Scooby-Doo and such, and to see her, but seriously, she's grown as an actress, and this role
she's
right here, she is, but in this movie right here, I think it's probably, in my opinion, like her best role. It's not that she carried the movie or was in it, but every scene she was in, there was a charm and sweetness about her, and loving her husband for who he was, and the scene where she takes the glasses out of the thing, it was like, you saw the anger in her face, and she's like, just gives that look. But she knows her husband.
That's my husband.
That's my husband. But there was a love there. It's like you said, they were in love since high school, Vigo and Linda. They were very good, but she was fantastic, I felt, in a very supporting role. I thought she was a great woman. And again, she has the line of the... She's the line that lights up the screen at the end. Thank you for helping my husband with his letters.
Mm-hmm. Well, she even... I mean, I don't know how it would have turned out if she said no, but she gave the go-ahead for him to go.
Yeah.
So that's a very powerful thing that she had. I would like to think she had quite a bit of control in that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think to her, too, the fact that Doc Shirley reached out to her... And she was like, I don't want to talk to him. She takes the phone begrudgingly and then goes, oh, wait, you're asking for my opinion? I'm the one. Wow. Okay. And she got to state her opinion. And she did it from a practical sense.
Yeah, and I think in that moment she was reacting to, like, just... Tony is a perfect mirror to the types of phone calls she probably is used to having. Because he opens up with, hey. Just, that's it.
Every phone call, hey.
And, you know, so she's probably used to that type of interaction. And most people that probably would call Tony for a job like, hey, I know he said no, but I need him. And can you talk some sense into the guy? Like, come on.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, tell him to do it for you or something. But make it happen. Whereas... We've seen even before that, but then certainly after, Don Shirley has this disarming demeanor, and the fact that he does ask her is something that no other person probably would. Again, go back to that comment of like, yeah, I'll write you a letter when you make me dinner. That's what she's used to,
and it's a great sign of respect.
Exactly.
I think that she, yeah, absolutely. And again, it's just one of those scenes, very simply done, but has so much more into it. And I think it works because of the performance of Linda Cardellini. So,
I definitely want to spend a lot of time talking about the music, but one of the things I will say also, it was in the editing, it was Vigo's suggestion to just begin the movie so you're captured by it rather than having this artifice put in front of you of like, oh, this is who made it and so forth. Like, nope, we're just right in and that's it.
Yeah, no opening credits or titles.
Yeah.
No.
You know what movie you're in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a great way to do it. And to open up inside the Copacabana, of all places, too, you had a great sense of the music, the energy.
The time, the
makeup, the costuming. It was really, it was a good, like, swinging way to kick this movie off. Because music is so important.
Well, speaking of that, let's talk about it.
Sure.
Because one of the aspects I appreciated... we talk about this a lot, but when you have instrumental music versus music with lyrics, generally instrumental music can survive, be timeless. And even though this was set in the 60s, it really felt, you know, like if I went to some bar and listened to his music, yeah, I could get behind it. And even towards the end with the blues music and the jazz and so forth, like it really worked and it resonated.
Yeah, and I think the great thing about music is it's a universal language.
Absolutely.
Everyone can enjoy music, no matter like what gender you are, what age you are, what race you are. It's like music speaks to everybody, and I think that's what like really connected Doc Shirley to everybody, no matter what their racism or prejudice they had against him. They still enjoyed his performance and his talent.
Yeah, and I think, too, that was the beginning of the bonding process when we had Tony the Lip, right, watching Doc Shirley play for the first time. And he was like going, wow, he really is an amazing musician. And he's like, and he was smiling, going, wow, this guy's great. Even his first letter, yes, he's better than I would have imagined. He's like brilliant at what he does. Music is bonding into, music can bring people together. We see that at the club at the end of the movie.
Which is a big part because, you know, Tony's big thing has like, you know, like, listen, anybody can play Chopin and so forth, but you, like, you got your own thing. And that is the big part of the movie is Don Shirley coming out of his own skin and just allowing himself to be himself.
Right.
Right, and I liked his talent goes across all aspects because we saw throughout the whole film and like how much he wanted to play on a Steinway
right.
piano. That was like a running thing. It's in his contract. It has to be a certain type of piano until we finally get the end bar at the end. Clearly not a Steinway. But it doesn't matter what piano he's on. His talent and his love for the performing and the music showcases on whatever instrument he does.
Yeah.
So, and I like that.
And again, I love the way that whole scene was set up. They're at the bar. So what are you, a cop? Do I look Irish? That was when she goes, well, what about you? What are you? Oh, he's like one of the best pianists in the world. Really? Well, go ahead. Prove it. And he's like, go ahead, doc. And she's like, no. He didn't want to be the quote unquote performer. It's like, no, go ahead. And he walks up in a tux in a place that's
with coattail,
yeah, coattail, bow tie, yeah,
and still has the same demeanor. Like, but you know, he didn't just like sit down, whatever. He made sure, like he was,
yep. And he looks, and I love that. I love that recall of the bourbon glass, and he puts it down, and then he starts playing his music, and then the tempo changes and the band comes up and he just let it rip and he wailed and the whole place stopped because they didn't know what they're getting from this guy and they got a concert. They got a great jazz swing concert.
Free concert.
For free, and it was amazing. And that too, like again, I said the line earlier, which is like, I would do that for free at least once a month. I would just
it showed
do
his
that.
Ability to adapt because yes. He wasn't the driving force of that music. As you said, the band came in and they hit that string first.
Oof. Yeah.
And then he's like, okay, I get what you're going for. I can enhance this. So it wasn't a taking over, it was in support of.
Yeah.
Which I appreciate.
It was a great scene. And to see everybody just stop and then whoa, and they're all clap, it was great. Great scene.
So, Marissa, at the top of the show, you mentioned you found out about this movie through Chris.
Chris Bowers, who's been here. Go check out our On the Fly filmmaking interview. Mary Lou Mandel interviewed him. He came in the summer, so this was like already about 6 months ago. But he talked about, so we know Mahershala Ali is a great actor, but he couldn't play piano to the extent that Chris Bowers can. So he was actually the body double, and they recorded him and all of his hand movements, and he's the one who's actually playing the piano for every performance you see of Doc Shirley. And then they imposed Mahershala Ali's head onto him. So, but even before that, Chris Bowers was a part of the composing of the actual music. So he did go back to like tapes and recordings of the original docs and he took that music, but he kind of, not to say modernized it, but like made it his own to today's music and helped compose it so it could translate to mm-hmm. people in 2018. Mm-hmm. So he was very, very part of the production of the sound and the sound mixing and the composing for the music for the entire film, let alone being the body double from Mahershala Ali.
Now, that said, they did credit Mahershala Ali for, like, he took quite a bit of lessons. Mm-hmm. So by the end, like, obviously he wasn't world-renowned quite yet, but he can do some stuff, too.
He was, and it looked, I have to say, it looked fantastic on screen because, all right, so we go to the movies more than the average person, right? So you can sort of figure out the trickery, meaning show close-up of the hands,
cut to the head,
but don't show the hands, and then cut from behind.
Yeah, so when you have a wide shot,
right.
Yeah, so you don't know.
But with this movie, it was very clean as to pulling back and like seeing Marcelo Ali play. And I was like, he looks like he's actually playing. He must have learned how to do some stuff. He looks good at it, you know? So in the music too, the music was sweeping from beginning to end. You know, I like that sort of jazz, and it was, you know, it was energizing when it needed to be, solemn when it needed to be. It was a really decent soundtrack. It was a good movie, and people yet they won't necessarily look at it as score.
Well, that's the big thing. Like for Golden Globes, it can't be nominated for that reason because it's not. It's pre-existing music,
right.
Yeah.
In essence. I don't know. What do you guys fall on that?
I mean, I understand. I mean, when like Beauty and the Beast that came out back in 2017, didn't really get nominated for the music because a lot of it, we've heard the music before.
Sure.
I mean, that's Alan Menken. There was a new song that was added to it because of Alan Menken and the wonderful Celine Dion, but like it couldn't get nominated because it wasn't technically original music.
Right.
And so it does suck when you have like good music, but it's already done.
They need like a, you know how they have with screenplays, best original, best
adapted music?
Yeah, best adapted. Yeah, adapted music maybe.
I
don't know. Just the thought.
In certain cases, I mean, you know, this. Well, yes, the same would go for Bohemian Rhapsody, right?
Yeah.
This movie is equally driven by the music, almost as equally as Bohemian Rhapsody, which is really driven by the music. But this one's about a musician.
Same as Star Is Born.
Yeah, and
had to throw that in there.
Well, you get but A Star Is Born is original music.
But that's original music. So, that's why they got
you
nominated.
That's a score, and they don't exist. Mm-hmm. So you have to do original music because they don't exist. Queen exists. Doc Shirley exists. He has the albums and such. But it's how it's performed. It's how it comes across through the speakers in your theater. It's how it engages an audience. And even if it opens an audience up who may not be familiar with this music, maybe they'll download the soundtrack. Maybe they'll want to expose themselves to this kind of jazz, mm-hmm. Which I think is brilliant. So... You know, I don't know. Maybe the best adapted music category for when it's needed. But then you got to go, well, how many movies come out a year? I mean, music drove this movie. We were talking about the music, which is fantastic. But I think we focus on performance, screenwriting, and direction of this movie really add up to make this whole.
So this movie has an A+ cinema score. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So kudos to them. Where do you guys land? There's some speculation, or not speculation, but this idea that they went too wide too fast. They open up November 16th, limited. Then Thanksgiving week, they open up 1,000 theaters. And they didn't, according to some people, they didn't hit the mark that they should have.
And even 1,000's not wide enough.
No, I think that they've been handling... Well, number one is Universal. I mean, they have Focus. This doesn't go out through Focus, which I would have thought that this would have been that kind of a movie, because Universal usually does not platform a release. They did so here. Again, I think that they've been doing everything okay. I don't think that it was like released too quickly. It is building that crest. It is building that wave. And I know we talk about this on like Meet the Movie Press. We've touched upon it here. There are just so many damn movies coming out. Like, how do you separate yourself from the pack, right? We talked about it when we talked about Instant Family. Could it have benefited from another release date because it was so crowded, right? But this movie, you release it limited. It's been getting really decent reviews. Crowds and audiences really enjoy it. And now with the Golden Globe nominations that it's had, it only helps intensify that wave. And Universal will be able to open it on more and more screens throughout the country, allowing more and more people to see it. I believe this past week it opened up. It was like number 7. The movie itself has made 23. No, it's made 15 million, 15, 16 yeah. million dollars.
Like 15, 16.
And we got a $23 million budget. I think this movie goes right through the holidays.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And if you think about it, the movie does have a specific timeline. It covers 8 weeks 2 months, supposedly, leading up to Christmas. Mm-hmm. And this is the month of Christmas. Now we're in December. So it does make sense that they're releasing it at this time of the year, even though it's like, it is a family traveling movie. You can watch this at any time of the year. But also, it helps because this is a good time for them to release it because of music and performances for mm-hmm. We Are at the start of the nominations. A lot of Golden Globe nominations so far for the 2019 awards season is that... Vice got a bunch of nominations. The movie isn't even out in theaters right. yet for people to see. This movie is more wide than Vice is, and Vice already has nominations, right. where the normal audience hasn't seen that movie yet. True. So
yeah, some of these movies, I'm like, what is this?
It's like, this is a good movie. It's a good time to be out right now.
Yeah, and I also think, and I'm gonna repeat something that I said when we talked Instant Family. I think it's a movie that's needed right now. Because I truly believe, because it has that good natured charm and good feeling aspect to it, so that when you get up at the end of the movie, you feel pretty good. Feel good, and you walk out going, "That was a really good movie." Yeah. Like, I felt good watching this movie.
The only knock on I have is I loved the pictures, the text, a little bit fast, a little bit small.
Oh, at the end,
yeah. Mm-hmm. That was my only knock.
Yeah, but yeah, and it's, we need more types of crowd pleasers. Mm-hmm. And this one fits the bill because it has everything in it as well. So, you know, I'm glad it, you know, we talked about the family, right? The Vallaloga family. This movie was a family effort. I mean, took 50 years for this movie to get from script to screen, and it all happened with the oldest son, Nick. Nick was the person who appreciated this relationship and wanted to see this through. And he was like, I could make 50 movies about my dad being at the Copacabana and being Don Rickles. I love the picture with him and Don Rickles, by the way, so it was great. But seeing him like Frank Sinatra, yeah, that probably could have been other stories. I'm glad they showed this one, and he actually recorded Doc Shirley and his dad with conversations, and I think it comes through. I mean, this movie is a family affair in a sense. It still is. It's still within the family,
and it cements Tony the Lip, right?
Right.
Because I love that moment when Don Shirley tells him, like, you talk too much, essentially. He said, you know, my wife says the same thing. And he just continues talking about how she tells him he talks too much.
It's the way you said it. My doc says...
It's quiet time. And he keeps talking.
Yeah, it... you know, I think that... that scene was great. Because, like, yeah, my wife says that the same way.
Yeah. So let's talk nominations, shall we? So number one, it is nominated as a musical or comedy. These are the Golden Globes. We don't have right. Oscars yet. So musical or comedy, Best Picture. Musical or comedy, Best Actor for Viggo. Best Supporting is, of course, Mahershala Ali. No nod to Linda Cardellini, which is... It's kind of a bummer.
Yeah,
I am. I mean, I think it's her best role.
Yeah, and she's
had some good roles. She's not in this movie a lot,
but there have been other people who have been nominated
for less.
Yeah,
for true. Less,
so you know, I look at it from that perspective. Like we mentioned, nothing for score, and that's it. So three nominations ultimately.
Yeah.
I don't know. Thoughts? You think it's going to win any of those?
Because it does help that Viggo Mortensen and Mahershala Ali were just nominated. And, like, Mahershala has won before. But they were both nominated the same year, back in 2017, in the same awards season. So, like, they already have, like, a leg up and the recognition for just acting status. So they're definitely going to get nominated again. Right. It's still a little early in the movie releases for the Oscar seasons because Vice has yet to come out, even though they got nominated. So more people have seen this movie than they have Vice.
Let me contextualize it. So let's start with Best Motion Picture, musical or comedy, right? This is Golden Globes. Crazy Rich Asians, The Favorite, Green Book, Mary Poppins Returns, and Vice. I have seen two of those five.
Yeah. And three of those five aren't even out yet in theaters.
Right.
For the regular public audience to see. Yeah.
I mean, Crazy Rich Asians was fun. Right. It would be cool for that. Like, listen, if that movie won over this, I wouldn't be mad necessarily. Just two different flavors, ultimately. Two great movies,
yeah.
I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But but this movie, I mean, we have to bring this up. There is a controversy surrounding this movie, surrounding Viggo Mortensen, actually, as well, which he has been. Personally, I don't think it's quite fair. I mean, he used the N-word, but he was using the word in the context of this movie and of the time period. He wasn't calling anybody that. He wasn't using the movie. He wasn't tossing the word out
derogatorily
towards anybody or derogatory period.
He was trying to use it in an educational context, right, to help
to
heighten
the time, right, and to the movie. And oversensitivity factors in, and you know, it's, I think the biggest mistake too is when you had some, like, Marshala Ali was like, yeah, it was unfortunate. Mahershala Ali says it was unfortunate he used that word. Again, to use it in a way where there's a context within this movie, which deals with racism, but now he can't be part of, they're really not using him on any part of campaign or anything. So his performance hopefully will really be remembered. But it's a sad controversy that he got wrapped up in. And I know, too, you've heard he's very sad that it happened. He didn't want to bring that upon the movie.
Well, now the focus is on that. When what he was ultimately trying to get across was that that racism is bad, and this movie kind of helps illustrate that.
Right.
So, yeah, I get... You know, let's see. So let's talk about best actor in a supporting role in any motion picture. So this is comedies, musicals, and dramas. As we said, Green Book is nominated. So Mahershala Ali, mm-hmm. Timothy Chalamet for Beautiful Boy, Adam Driver for Black Klansman, Richard E. Grant for Can You Ever Forgive Me, and Sam Rockwell for Vice. So three out of those five I have seen. I have not seen Can You Forgive Me or Vice. I think, to me, I honestly, but right now, I think it's between Adam Driver and Ali. I think they both... Ali takes it a little bit more because I think he carries the movie more so than Adam Driver. But
that's a tough one for me because Adam Driver was so strong in Black Klansman. Yeah. I mean, he was... That was a tour de force.
From start to finish with everyone.
From top to bottom in that movie. But when you look at Adam Driver... Especially, you know, look, we loved him in Logan Lucky. He was brilliant in that
movie. I loved
him
in Girls.
Yeah, but I'm just talking like movies, you know, and he's coming off of Kylo Ren. When he's able to put in a performance like this in Black Klansman, that there were so many subtleties that he had to, as a Jewish character, had to cope and deal with in Black Klansman. I don't know. He's going to be the tough one to beat, as good as Mr. Ali is, I think, and he's very good, but
yeah, I mean, listen, it's a wealth of riches.
And two strong movies that our audience are good movies. Like they're coming from solid movies that audiences can appreciate very much.
Yeah. Marissa, where do you stand on any of these nominations?
Well, I definitely think Mahershala Ali, because I always mention there has to be like one or two key moments where you're like, yeah, that's the moment where you get the nomination. And like the moment for Green Book for Mahershala was when he's just standing out in the rain with the whole spiel of like, if I'm not white enough, I'm not this. If I'm not black enough, I'm not cultured. What have you, like that whole spiel. I was like, yeah, that's the moment. They would cut that and isolate that scene out just to show it up on screen. Like, during the whole presentation for him. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic. I can't really speak too much because I haven't seen Black Klansman.
There's a lot of scenes from that you could pull out of Adam. The fact that he basically is forced to say that he hates Jews when he's a Jew himself in order to be undercover. Like, that scene alone.
And in a sense, he was almost, at the beginning of the movie, not, I don't want to say a self-hating Jew, but he was a Jew that never really followed the tradition. But it was because of there was such hatred that he began to take Judaism more seriously. But I don't want to take away from the performance that we're talking about here, because, again, not only is it an individual performance, but I think as a combination performance, you said it at the top, this is fantastic casting. Yeah. Like, and all you needed is one weak link. If somebody overplays their part, the movie doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It just doesn't work. And again, Viggo Mortensen is transformative by gaining the weight and becoming Teddy the Lip. It was great. It was their chemistry together too. You felt as if while making this movie and being together that they themselves became true friends and appreciative of their creativity.
Absolutely. So, well,
I want to do one more thing. We haven't talked about Octavia Spencer had
producing
a tad bit of influence on this movie. And she helped champion this story, and she offered her passion, insight, and advocacy to the Green Book, and she joined the filmmaking team as an executive producer during the early stages of development. And there isn't being much said about this, but I think that what she was able to bring, and she had an enthusiasm for telling this story that I know that the filmmakers, Farrelly and company, were really proud to have her on board and take her wisdom and creativity.
She's a very smart woman. I think it's last year coming off with working with Denzel Washington, and you know, I mean, that's just a minor speck on her spectrum of work, you know.
Right. Yeah, I mean, she's had a great run in the last 10 years. Like, with the help getting her win, she was in The Shape of Water, which was the best picture last year.
She was in Instant Family.
She was also in the Hidden Figures.
Yeah.
You know, and she also got nominated for that. So, like, she's had her list of movies in the last even 5 years have all been recognizable.
And crowd pleasers.
Yeah.
You know, they're people just, that audiences.
Last week.
Right, yeah.
She's fantastic.
She is in movies that audiences gravitate to in so many different diverse ways.
And drama.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Comedy and drama. She's versatile.
Very much so. And much like when we talked about, you know, say, Instant Film, this movie juggled. Again, this movie could have gone either way. This could have been a straight-out movie of just racism across the country.
Well, that's what, right? I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, it could have been.
Because I heard it was drama. Like, because someone, even Chris Bowers, in his interview, compared it to, like, Driving Miss Daisy, which is more of a, like, kind of a drama. And for, like, Oscar season, so, like, my head automatically went to drama.
Yeah, and it could have been, right? But the juggling and the fine balance of adding, like, comedy throughout, salt and pepper throughout, at great moments, I think elevate the movie and make it, and through the comedy, you still get the themes. Without them, we're intelligent moviegoers. We understand the themes. We don't need it to come down like an anvil on our head. And I think the comedy helps. The comedy helps bring audiences in, too, I think.
Yeah, and that is the more surprising aspect of it. All right, well, we've talked well over an hour at this point about this movie, which is certainly fine. It deserves the recognition. But it is, for us, time to wrap it up. But that doesn't mean the conversation is over. That is, you as an audience, you get to participate, and you guys have been participating, so thank you, thank you, thank you. Leave us a comment, let us know your thoughts when you do get to see it. It's the holiday season, you're catching up on a lot of stuff, and the great part is, movies are so timeless, and I'm amazed to go back in time when you guys catch up with some of these movies, and you comment that the fact that you guys, in essence, make these movies live on forever. So that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. So I want to take the time to acknowledge you and encourage you. In the meantime, if you want to interact more directly with any of us, at Serafini TV.
That's right.
At DMovies1701.
Please do. I'm actually in the process of, I'll let you guys know, but I'm rebranding my thing. Right. But when it happens, I'll let you know.
Exciting stuff.
At this song right here, this is a testament of the time, too. Because as that fight was going on, did you notice the band didn't...
They didn't flinch.
They didn't flinch.
It was just a normal Tuesday. That's what I took it as. All right. And I'm Phil Svitek. Thank you for joining us. And, of course, this is At the Popcorn Talks. And check out other movies. And speaking of which, as you catch up, we have a long list of movies that we've done in the past. I think pretty much over 500. And we've got a lot more movies to go. So keep checking back in. Bye.
Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of its owners or principals.